Hello and welcome to the Doorsteps podcast with Dr. Cody Price. This is our special Halloween episode, and we have decided to have some fun with this month's episode as we talk about historic rehab projects. Historic rehab can reveal some real treats, but it can also hide some real tricks. Before we get started, I have a treat to share with you all. I am joined by Samantha Makowski, housing grant analyst at OFA, who will be co-hosting this episode with me. Sam works on the 9% low-income housing tax credit program as an analyst. Welcome to the podcast, Sam.
Thanks, Cody. I'm really excited to join you to talk about historic rehab.
So, Sam, what are you going to be for Halloween?
I don't think I'm going to be dressing up for Halloween because I'm currently in the process of making a Bubble Guppies costume for my 2-year-old, so I'm running a bit short on time, but I'm so excited to be here. Some of the most interesting and complicated projects I've had at OFA have been historic deals.
And so for the second treat, I would like to introduce you all to our guest today, Joseph M. McCabe, who is joining us today to talk about some spooky housing rehabs. Joe is the Vice President of Development for Woda Cooper Companies and has over a decade of experience in real estate development. He has supervised and completed a variety of multifamily, senior, independent living, and scattered site affordable housing development initiatives throughout Ohio, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina. Mr. McCabe attended the State University of New York at Buffalo, where he obtained his Bachelor's of Professional Studies, Master of Architecture, and Certificate of Universal Design. And so thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this.
Hi, Joe. What can you tell us about WOTA's work with historic rehab?
Well, we can fill you in on a lot of little details here because I think it takes sort of getting familiar with what a tax credit is and what the projects really encompass, starting by the fact that it really varies state to state. In Ohio, for example, if you're working on a project, you might be eligible for federal historic preservation credits. But within the state of Ohio, you have to compete in one of the pools, either a small, medium, or large pool. That large pool is also kind of called a mega pool. Very few projects go to the mega pool size. Very few projects sort of go to the small end of the spectrum. But the bulk of the projects sort of fall in the middle. In a place like Pennsylvania, for example, the rules are a little different. The funding's a little different. It doesn't have the same, it has the same competitive process, but the opportunity for state historic credits is a bit less, where they cap you out at about 500,000 state credits and only give away about 3 million annually. That's really different than, say, a place like New York. Now, by disclaimer that WOTA does not work in New York, but I have a lot of friends in preservation and they do work in New York. And a place like New York is very preservation friendly, where they offer an almost unlimited pool of 20% credits to pair with the federal 20%, meaning that up to 40% of the qualified historic rehab costs are really covered. So you can see that really is different state by state. And as a developer, you have to take that into consideration based on your location. But I think probably today we want to focus in on Ohio, where we are.
What have you experienced in Ohio with our state historic tax credit?
Well, we've been fairly successful in Ohio in the state historic preservation process, especially as it applies to projects with affordable housing and repositioning these old types of buildings as putting new life into them. So when we look at it, generally the first thing we try to do is figure out, you know, is the building eligible to be listed? Is it in a historic district? Thinking about things like hiring a historic preservation architect, because you've got to have somebody who's very in tune with the process, understands the details of dealing with historic skins, historic fabric, negotiating that process. I would say that they're probably some of the most complex projects, as you've already alluded to on your side of the equation. It's also just as complicated on our side of the equation as a developer, because you have to negotiate not one, not two, but really three or more agencies at a time. There's really what OFA wants to get out of a project, which is very important, but there's also what the local, and being local, I mean the State Office of Historic Preservation, what their goals are. And then their decisions have to be blessed by the National Park Service. So you're at least making three entities or organizations happy, in addition to your local building, planning, zoning officials, and a multitude or a host of other people. So it's a quite complicated process with perhaps a lot of masters. So when we think about kind of what buildings might be eligible for historic projects or repositioning, adaptive reuse, generally they have to meet some basic criteria. And that criteria is pretty much equal across all states, because the key or the gateway is to be either in a National Register listed district or to have a building that's individually listed on the National Register. And the general criteria for that is that the property should be at least 50 years old. That's usually a threshold starting point. However, there are exceptions. I do want to point out that there's other criteria that could lead you to be considered a historic building. One of those is what they call criteria A, which is your property. And I want to say not just building, because it includes other places like burial grounds, cemeteries. It can actually be an environment, a natural habitat component, and not necessarily is always just a bricks and mortar huge structure like many people think about historic buildings. So the place, let's say, has to be or could be associated with an event or contribute to broader history. For example, a building that was involved in Martin Luther King's lifetime was put on the National Register well before that 50-year mark because of its path and change in history and the impact it made on rights in America and a lot of other political issues. Generally, buildings that are also significant in the relationship to a specific person. So it could be somebody very famous. It could be, you know, a musician. It could be a political player. It could be a founder of our country, for example. You know, think about Ben Franklin's house. Go to Philadelphia. There's a lot of early founders of our country. Their homes and places they did business in are on the National Register. So that's yet another criteria. Another one would be if it's an exceptional work of architecture, and that it represents a very distinctive character. Say, for example, a building that has a lot of really great ornamental detailing from a specific period, and we would call that like a masterwork of art almost, if you will. But likewise, then you might find in a more rural area or in some neighborhoods, you may just have an exceptional example of a craftsman revival house, for example. Its detailing might have been done by a builder, maybe not an architect, but it's explicitly an example of that period, and you can find a lot of its intact details that say, I'm a prime example of a certain era or snapshot in time. The other thing that they sometimes, the reason I pointed out that's not always buildings, is there's a fourth criteria, which is it may yield or has yielded information or history on history or prehistory. So that takes into account some of the burial ground sites. You might get those along the Appalachian or Ohio River Valley areas. That those other parts of the country have, you know, perhaps archaeological areas. So there are areas where there's opportunity to find yet information that those might be landmarked as well.
And so why is it really important to bring life back into the building rather than demolish it and build new? So how is this decision really made on, like, does it need to have the designation first to actually receive the historic tax credits, or can it just be any building that is considered historic to receive the credits?
So when we're looking at specifically obtaining historic credits for historic preservation, not every project necessarily has to have historic credits to be a historic preservation project. You know, if it's needed in the financing, that's the preferable route to go. Just because of your preserving history, there's an oversight agency monitoring the level of construction activity, and it sort of ensures that details that are related to the history of that building are not lost forever or replaced. And really, it's one of the toughest decisions that I think we face as a developer, is that not every building can be saved by us. And there are examples. You know, WOTA, for example, has many schools in our portfolio, as well as some other historic buildings. I've walked into probably dozens of schools in my career so far at WOTA and literally had to say, sorry, this is not the right opportunity for us. And while most people get romantically caught up in the idea of preservation as a way to convert or save a building, we have to look at why the building isn't maybe used today in its current form. And quite frankly, when you look at a lot of the historic schools, several of those were built during the Works Progress Administration era, the WPA era. And when you think about the, you know, schools, for example, big, vast, wide corridors, small classrooms, well, those are not good recipes for conversion to housing. You sort of want larger classrooms and small corridors, especially when you think about operationally what that would be long term. You don't want spaces that are sort of spaces that can't be rented, can't be used efficiently by their new occupants, despite how nice the school might be. And so when you look at a decision, whether it's the right fit. Each developer could come up with their own response. But when we look at a building, it's from the through the eyes or lenses of will it operate efficiently? Will it be the right decision for our tenants long term? Will it help them with their costs? You know, there's a lot of things that go into it. I think about the exceptionally high ceilings, for example, in a school building. And what does that then mean to air conditioning and heating costs and the utilities used by that tenant to be sustainable in that unit? So there are some challenges, especially when it's disproportionate amounts of space. I had made a note just thinking in preparation for this. We think about a lot of grand historic architecture out of them out there. A lot of those buildings have really big signature spaces, like you know, big vaulted lobby spaces, or think about like a cathedral-like church setting. Those are spaces that, as you go through the historic preservation process, you wouldn't necessarily be able to subdivide. And the SHPO, the State Office of Historic Preservation, and the National Park Service are likely to require you to keep those signature spaces intact and undivided. And what ends up happening is you just don't have enough uses of those spaces to really offset rehabbing or repurposing the building. So again, not every historic building is going to be fit for an OFA project, although it's admirable when the two can sort of cross paths.
Wota Cooper Companies has completed several historic adaptive reuse projects in several states. What sort of challenges have you run into with these types of projects?
Well, the biggest issue, quite frankly, is always the unknowns. It's what's hidden in the walls. It's what's hidden in areas you can't see. You know, when you think about architects, even when architects do new construction, there's challenges along the way because we don't build watches. We don't have micro precision. Things change in the field. Materials, you know, get installed and, you know, the tolerances, there's always tolerances. But when you're working in preservation, those walls are fixed. And depending on the size of the building, that could mean hundreds, if not thousands, of openings, walls, and dimensions to be recorded. And there's always an opportunity to have something that doesn't quite line up like it's supposed to in the end. I can think back to some of our projects where, you know, accessibility may be a challenge, where you're trying to link some buildings to make an ADA path, and the floors may not align from one wing of the building to the next wing of the building. And so you have some complicated, you know, sloping issues. Or I can think about times we may have opened up a shaftway and found unanticipated old piping that maybe has an asbestos wrap or something on it that required further remediation and removal. And that really sort of then puts a stop on a project or creates a change. Of course, it's always good to be planning for those conditions. Sometimes when you look at water damages in a lot of historic buildings are usually typically vacant or have been vacant for several decades with no heat. You start getting into the structural repairs, and maybe the structural repairs require further detailing or much more extensive work than you originally anticipated. So I'd say the devil's in the details, but those details are then also hidden. So it takes an appetite of being able to, you know, be willing to get into the unknown.
And so you've obviously worked with a lot of different projects. Is there a particular favorite that comes to mind with a historic project?
Sure. One of the projects we just recently finished up not too long ago is a project down in Nelsonville called Nelsonville School Commons. It's actually a series of two distinguished yet different architecturally appealing schools that sit side by side and are linked by a series of historic bridges added a little bit later in the building's life. One of the schools dates to 1907 and is very classic revival, but with some Germanic classic revival detailing. The other one, the other building is from 1924, and although is less appealing to the eye, when we talk about the building's historic importance, for example, it's not an ugly building by any means, but it's just a simpler building. And that 1924 building, to me, was really interesting because it was designed by an architect named William Mills, and Mills was an immigrant from England who moved to the U.S., was a telegraph agent, and ultimately went to school for architecture and opened a firm in Nelsonville, became very prominent in the Nelsonville, Athens area. And a number of churches, homes, and municipal buildings throughout that Appalachian county are actually designed by Mills. So it's sort of appropriate in this day and age when we think about all the discussion going on about immigration and immigration policies. Here's a really wonderful example of somebody who created some really brilliant stuff and became sort of sought after and became known and very distinguished in his field. So I thought that was a kind of an interesting building from my standpoint. It was a very challenging building. It was a building that it was condemned partway through the project. And had we probably not saved it, it was probably just months away, really, from a bulldozer. So the town had no hope. We sort of were out there looking for potential projects, and we crossed paths with one of the leaders of a small 9-10 person nonprofit group that had bought the school just to save it and had been nursing it through just decades of time, just keeping it secure, thinking maybe one day it could be something. Well, I guess we ended up being that answer to them and saving the building.
And so, I mean, you were kind of talking about the historic significance of the schools. And so were there any other treats that you guys kind of found with the project? Anything that kind of stuck out for you guys?
Yeah, I think one of the real joys or treats of the whole thing is that you have units that are unique. There's almost in a historic preservation, there's almost no two units that end up being the same. And you really don't have a sort of cookie cutter environment by any means. I think a lot of people quickly think about, oh, cool, old school, let's make it senior apartments. Well, as we've started to really think about it, well, why wouldn't young people want to live in a cool classroom space that's been converted to an apartment as well? And so, you know, for example, in Nelsonville, it's just seeing the joy of having small families move into those units, enjoying those spaces, and actually bringing an element of a younger generation into a school that maybe they didn't experience, you know, firsthand, much like some of the seniors that now live there did at one point. But to see them be able to kind of embrace that historic building and kind of call it their own and interact with that historic fabric in a new way, I think that's one of the real treats, if you will.
And what sort of tricks did Nelsonville have for you?
Well, the tricks were pretty heavy sometimes. In that scenario, as I had mentioned just a little earlier, the building was condemned, and that actually happened after we received an award of tax credits, but before we had started construction. A major portion of the older 1907 building had already collapsed and been removed by the city many years before we arrived on the scene, even proposing the idea of the reuse. But a large corner of the building and the rear started to tumble, and there was a large section of chimney that was starting to show signs of movement, and we had to go in rather immediately and put in some cathedral-like buttressing made out of steel to hold the building together. We had to very quickly work through an emergency process with the city officials to ensure that demolition didn't happen, because that would have meant loss of over 50% of the project, as well as working with the State Office of Historic Preservation and National Parks to ensure anything we did would not jeopardize their own process. So we took down a massive boiler chimney brick by brick, for example, and we put shoring and jacks inside the building to hold up the structure to ensure that really had the one corner of the building give way, we would have lost a few floors of classroom spaces as the joists would have tumbled, and all the decorative ceiling would have went with it too. So it would have been a real shame to lose a lot of the ornate original detail. But I guess, you know, right place at the right time. So one of the curveballs were thrown at us, but I guess we pulled out the bat and hit it back. So
this is our Halloween episode. Have there been any spooky or unexplained occurrences in any of your historic rehabs?
Well, generally, I would like to say that none of our buildings are haunted, because once we put new life into them, all the bad stuff goes away. There's always recently we were out at the 43 Town Square, the Lima Trust building, a project we finished and just placed in the service not all that many months ago. And during the course of finishing up some of the construction and prior to its occupancy, somebody in the city had been going by and talking to the property manager, and they had insisted they had saw, you know, it's a 12-story building with apartments all up to the 12th floor. They thought they heard noises at first and then saw lights sort of blinking and flashing, and they got panicked, and the property manager called the police right away. The police didn't find a single thing. They did walk the building thinking maybe it was somebody there just flickering switches, but the unexplained phenomenon has never occurred again, luckily, knock on wood, and we think our tenants have nothing to worry about. We don't know what that issue was, but luckily it's never happened again. And, you know, hopefully it was just something with some temporary lighting, or it was just nothing at all.
And so one of the things I like doing with these podcasts when talking to developers is really getting into the NIMBY issues. And so I think that you can provide kind of this unique perspective on looking at historic rehab projects. And do you kind of see a difference in NIMBYism with an historic rehab versus a new build that you guys might experience in a new community?
Yeah, you know, one of the things is just first when we try to overcome NIMBYism, one of the real issues is explaining to people the purpose of the tax credit program, what the tax credit program actually means, what the income levels are within their particular county or municipality. And it's always the fear of that one of these projects will have the same stigma that the mid-century public housing demonstration projects had. There was for those listening out there, they should really look at, there was a mid-century project called the Pruitt-Igoe housing development that was in St. Louis in 1954. And by 1960, it had become such a place of concentrated poverty and crime and racial segregation that it sort of set the stage for a lot of the negative stigma. There are very similar projects that really were built around the city of Chicago, and they became sort of synonymous with creating ghettos and concentrated poverty, and that the old-style housing that was often under housing authorities a long time ago and some of the housing development projects and processes is not what we build today, but yet that fear of it being just like that still continues. And so typically when we're in a community, we're explaining what the income levels are and how you qualify for a unit, and I would say that the newest form of NIMBYism, I think, is sort of less fear of the site, but it's actually when people unfortunately realize they may fit the definition of low income. When you start talking about some of the thresholds right here in Franklin County, example in Ohio, when we talk about somebody who may make 30, 40, 50 grand being on a civic commission and having a family and they're reviewing our project and we talk about what we're going to do and we say the word low income and then I give the ranges and then the light bulb goes off, that ding, all of a sudden this means me, they really kind of step back and you can watch the facial expression of them change. And I think they maybe get more offended when they're afraid I'm sort of talking about them. But in a way, I think that's a really positive thing. We're providing housing for people that are in that neighborhood. So we're not perfect at being able to navigate that process, but I think it's just the education of really what affordable housing is and who it is for. And it doesn't always mean this is permanent supportive housing, or it doesn't, you know, we have to clarify when there's, you know, Section 8 vouchers involved, or whether there's any addiction component or any of the other types of specialized housing components involved. And people just make a lot of assumptions, I think, right out the gate. But I think when it comes to sort of, I think the second part of your question, when we look at, do people think differently about historic rehabs and preservation and NIMBYism? I think they do, because they become nostalgic and they become romantic. They become romantically connected to the building and remembering a when, you know, specifically seniors quite often in towns, they remember the school when they went there. Or they remember a building when it was in pristine condition, and they sort of romantically want to go back to yesteryear of a better time, especially if it's in a town where it maybe is demographically not as good today. I also think that they're easier to digest for a community because generally the exteriors of historic buildings don't change significantly. Now, there's a lot of rules in place on a historic rehab project where you're saving certain components, and quite often that is the general look and feel of the building from many of its prominent views and angles. Not to say that there isn't an addition made for an elevator or a small addition made of housing units or something on the property, but the general building is fixed. It's a known quantity. Secondarily, it's usually built of substantially upgraded materials, higher-end materials that a lot of folks think about developers, and because they don't know a developer, they fear development, going back to the NIMBYism, they fear it may be like some of the cheap market rate development we've seen out there in this country, where developers make a promise and it's sort of a bait and switch scenario, and they end up getting a development built in their backyard that maybe doesn't look like the architectural rendering showed it. In the case of historic preservation, they can walk down the block and say, oh yeah, it's going to look like that, but it's going to now look new. It's not going to have boarded up windows. It's going to be repainted. It's going to have a new roof on it. You know, they're willing to accept that, I think, a lot easier because there's a lot of given quantities, at least as far as how the building is going to sit on a site or how it's going to maybe potentially impact them as a neighbor.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, because that's like a lot of the stuff that we've kind of focused on is really on that blending in, that match context and building in with the neighborhood. And so it's just like it's interesting seeing the historic rehab projects. It's an existing building that's already there. And so it already has that qualities that you were kind of talking about, that fitting in with the environment.
It's almost even a reversed scenario of where people often on the new construction fear the new project will impact them. In a historic building, sometimes, you know, it may be situated in a district where 20, 30, 40% of the buildings around it are actually more recent than that building. So those buildings are more impacting on the historic building. So I think, again, it goes back to the comfort level.
So after everything that we've kind of discussed today, what are the major takeaways that you would like our listeners to have?
Well, the biggest thing is that when we finish a project, the most gratifying thing is that there's always a 180 turnaround with most folks who are in a community after they see a historic preservation project, just because it's always that phrase of, I never thought it was going to be so nice. And there's something really great about coming away ethically and comfortably, you know, knowing you saved a piece of cultural history, of a town's identity, of a neighborhood identity, and that you've given it new life. That's not to say, though, that it doesn't come without great risk. And in fact, some of the big takeaways I'd really say there are is anybody who's ever thinking about one of these things, they're very expensive. There's no way to cut corners on preservation and to do it right. In order to make the 30-year plus investment that needs to be made to ensure new life is in the building and health and safety and welfare are all protected and residents, you know, are our first and foremost concern, there's no way to do these projects cheaper than new construction. So it's not going to be an appetite for everyone. Secondly, it's three times harder to coordinate. And as I had mentioned at the start of the podcast, there's at least three or more agencies you're going to work with. Typically, in a new construction project, the processes getting to the road to financing and closing are a lot quicker, and you're probably only dealing with one local jurisdiction on some permitting, maybe some other local commissions or such. But with a preservation project, you may be dealing with an architectural review board, with SHPO, with National Parks, with OFA and their criteria, with local planning and zoning officials, with even a local historic review board, if applicable. Certain cities even have those assigned to landmark buildings. So it's be prepared for a process, an administration process that takes much more time to get through on the front end, and then the closeout on the back end, because just like there's leasing up the units and the occupancy, that's where it doesn't end for a historic tax credit project. There's compliance for, much like there's compliance components for low-income housing, there's also compliance components for a historic tax credit to be able to get the report in to make sure you've reached all your qualified costs and those review components. And then there's guaranteeing that that building will not be altered for its minimum commitment of time, which is typically a 5-year period after it's completed. Now, the good news is that after 5 years, you're generally eligible for more historic credits for future things. But let's hope that at year six, you're not really looking to do substantial reinvestment again, especially given all the other things that are involved. But it definitely takes a lot more time and a lot more power to get that done internally. And then the other thing is just expect unique floor plans, unique units. No two things are the same. Even if you have a floor plan that is the same, you know, and it's sort of extruded vertically throughout a taller building, is as you find or uncover the unknowns, you're going to have to be flexible on design to make it work. One of the good things here in the state of Ohio is the Ohio Building Code has what we call Article 34, which allows for some exceptions and some ways to look at building code and understands that modern materials are not the same as older materials and that you might even have a form of, say, fireproof construction or safe construction. It acknowledges there's some value in that and helps you guide you through the upgrades you need to do to bring life and safety standards up to par. So there's some benefits to that. Likewise, fair housing law has some language about when the units are occupied as new units after March 13th, 1991. It has some exceptions for historic buildings in the way those buildings predating 1991 are viewed when it comes to fair housing. But there are definitely a lot of scenarios that it's not going to be like every other project in your portfolio. In fact, I don't think any of our historic projects, as I look down them, no two are ever alike. They're all so unique. They're all so different. They're all so very complicated to manage. So there's a lot of complexity in it. And then maybe lastly is just anybody ever considering this type of project from a development or operations or management perspective is be comfortable with the fact that you may not yield the profitability or the predictability that you're seeking. And you have to have a real hunger or appetite or desire to do these kinds of projects. They're amazing projects when they're done. There are often things that communities are very proud of. I know we're very proud of it, and I believe the agencies are proud of what we do, but they're definitely not something for everybody.
And so finally, if you could suggest one book that everyone read, what would it be and why?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll give you two, actually, that are kind of opposite of each other. There's probably some urban planning folks out there in the crowd, and I would suggest two different books here. One is Wrestling with Moses. It's a book by Anthony Flint. Really talks about Jane Jacobs' battle and really moving from grassroots to stopping kind of a mega, you know, development craze in the mid-century America and how it was changing our urban cities. And I can think about how that same strategy is applicable today, but maybe for some political issues or other things we're going through today. But then on the other side of that, as I always say, there's two sides to every coin or every story, is to look at another book, Robert Moses and the Modern City by Hilary Ballin, and really talks about what he was trying to achieve and to understand what was in the mindset of this man empowered or entrusted with forming an authority and changing the way we live, which has still impacted us today. So both his efforts have changed American cities pretty substantially, but then Jane Jacobs' efforts have sort of slowed those things, changed those things, and also made it what we have today. So that would be my suggestions.
And Sam, what would you suggest?
My book club recently read Climate Justice by Mary Robinson, which was a really great, informative read about how women in developing nations are really taking charge against climate change and really becoming political leaders on a global scale. And it's only 150 pages. It's a quick read, and I learned so much.
Well, we'll have to check out these books. So thank you guys so much for coming in and speaking to us today. And thank you, Sam, for co-hosting with me today on our
special Halloween episode.
Please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorsteps podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at
Ohio Doorsteps.
Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.